Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Jaya Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Sodanandana Braja Jana Ranjana Chasodanandana Braja Jana Ranjana. A little faster. Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Was I correct in seeing before that nobody is here for the first time? All right. Well, welcome back, everybody, to our Sunday feast lecture. In addition to taking a little bit of a risk with the mandolin here, I'm also taking a risk in that I believe I'm giving a class on a verse I've never given a class on before, if that's possible to believe. So this is Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. This is chapter 17, The Divisions of Faith, which was the title I gave for this lecture. Verse number 3. Sadvanurupa sarvasya. Sadvanurupa sarvasya. Shraddhabhavati Bharata Shraddhabhavati Bharata Shraddhamayoyam Purusho Shraddhamayoyam Purusho Yoyach Shraddhasa Evasa Yoyat Shraddha Sa Evasa Sadvanurupa Sarvasya Shraddhabhavati Bharata Shraddhamayoyam Purusho Yoyat Shraddha Sa Evasa. Please chant. Sadvanurupa sarvasya. Shraddhabhavati bharata. Shraddhabhavati bharata. Shradamayam yad puruso. Yo yat shraddha sa eva sa. Sadvanurupa sarvasya. Shraddha bhavati bharata. Shraddhayam yam purusho. Yo yat shraddha sa eva sa. Satvanurupa sarvasya. Shraddha bhavati bharata. Shraddha mayo yam purusho. Yo yat shraddha sa eva sa. Translation. O son of Bharat, according to one's existence under the various modes of nature, one evolves a particular kind of faith. The living being is said to be of a particular faith according to the modes he has acquired. Purport. Everyone has a particular type of faith regardless of what he is, but his faith is considered good, passionate, or ignorant according to the nature he has acquired. Thus, according to his particular type of faith, one associates with certain persons. Now, the real fact is that every living being, as stated in the 15th chapter, is originally a fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, one is originally transcendental to the modes of material nature. But when one forgets his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and comes into contact with material nature and conditional life, he generates his own position by association with the different varieties of material nature. The resultant artificial faith and existence are only material. Although one may be conducted by some impression or some conception of life, originally he is nirguna or transcendental. Therefore, one has to become cleansed of the material contamination that he has acquired in order to regain his relationship with the Supreme Lord. That is the only path back without fear, Krishna consciousness. If one is situated in Krishna consciousness, then the path is guaranteed for his elevation to the perfectional stage. If one does not take to this path of self-realization, then he is surely to be conducted by the influence of the modes of nature. That's half the purport. Prabhupada's going to change gears a little bit here. The word shraddha, or faith, is very significant in this verse. In fact, it appears 1, 2, 3 times. Shraddha, or faith, originally comes out of the mode of goodness. One's faith may be in a demigod or some created god or some mental concoction. One's strong faith is supposed to be productive of works of material goodness. But in material conditioned life, no works are completely purified. They are mixed. They are not in pure goodness. Yes, that is definitely a cause for tragedy. I agree. I'm also crying about this fact on a regular basis. Pure goodness is transcendental. In purified goodness, one can understand the real nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As long as one's faith is not completely in purified goodness, the faith is subject to contamination by any of the modes of material nature. The contaminated modes of material nature expand to the heart. Therefore, according to the position of the heart in contact with a particular mode of nature, one's faith is established. Excuse me. It should be understood that if one's heart is in the mode of goodness, his faith is also in the mode of goodness. If his heart is in the mode of passion, his faith is also in the mode of passion. And if his heart is in the mode of darkness, illusion, his faith is thus contaminated. Thus we find different types of faith in this world, and there are different types of religions due to different types of faith. The real principle of religious faith is situated in the mode of pure goodness, because the heart is tainted, we find different types of religious principles. Thus, according to different types of faith, there are different kinds of worship. Om Angyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Shtapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sva Padantikam. That purport seems shorter when I was reading it in my head over the last few days. So the first principle here is that spiritual life begins with an understanding that we, the living entity, inside of these bodies, walking around and doing things all the time, are substantially different than the body itself that we're walking around in doing things. The body is a combination of material elements, and material elements can be categorized in all kinds of different ways. In the modern world, we have the periodic table of elements, which has 118 some odd elements. Oh, I got two glasses of water now. Thanks. In the Vedas, elements are classified as 5 or 10 or 15, depending on how you want to break it all down. But behind all of these different material elements, there is a consciousness. And spiritual life begins by understanding that there's a difference between consciousness, which is the active principle of material energy, and the material nature itself, which is only animated when it comes in contact with consciousness. And that can include very big consciousnesses, like the consciousness underlying this entire universe, Lord Brahma. And it can also include very small consciousness. The Brahma Samhita mentions the Indra Gopam, which is some unnamed microscopic, or well, it's named the Indra Gopam. We don't know what it is, what it really is, but it's a little tiny microscopic creature. All of these bodies are animated by consciousness. And consciousness, of course, we know consists of three different modes of consciousness. There is a mode of consciousness that is conducive to creating things. We call this the mode of passion or rajagun. There's a mode of passion, there's a mode of nature that is conducive to destroying things. We call this tamogun, or the mode of ignorance. And then there's a mode of nature that brings balance between these two things and is conducive to sustenance and maintenance. And this is the mode of goodness. And there are millions upon millions of different forms of life. The Padma Purana says that there are 8.4 million species of life, and it divides them up into living entities that are immobile, like plants, for example, mosses, ferns, flowering plants, cacti, you name it. Living entities that live in the sea, swimming around, doing their sea creature thing. Living entities that walk on land and four-legged, tetrapods they're called in modern biology. And then, of course, there are the two-legged animals, the hominids. Right, and all of these different forms of life that we see in the material world arise due to various permutations of consciousness of the living entity that is inhabiting these bodies. And for the most part, this is just going on for countless trillions of years. Lord Brahma lives for over 311 trillion of our years, and that is just an inconceivable amount of time, frankly. And that's just one lifetime of one Lord Brahma. And these Lord Brahmas are coming in and out of existence forever. For eternity, we say. But in reality, it is impossible for the human mind to fathom what that means, right? I know I look back on my childhood, for example, the 1980s, the late 1970s, the early 1980s, and somehow in the back of my mind, I think this was like 20 years ago, but it's not. This was much longer than that. So, and then I see that I'm also among the younger people in the room. So our concept of time is limited, and this is indicative of us being conditioned by the material energy that we've associated with due to the quality of our consciousness over countless millions of lifetimes. And so we're kind of trapped here, right? The Bhagavad Gita says, Prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasa ahankara vimudatma kartaham iti manyate. That bewildered by these modes of material nature that we're associating with, we start to think that we are the doers, that we are the cause of our own actions, when in fact everything in this world is moving by the impulses of material energy within the purview of eternal time. But we are so foolish that we think we are doing things, right? All we are really doing in this world is desiring. All we are really doing in this world is desiring. And where we choose to put our desires is indicative of what we have faith in. And that's what Prabhupada is mostly saying in the second part of this purport, that what our intent is leads to what we have faith in. And in the subsequent verses here in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada and Krishna will begin to talk about what are really the divisions of faith. People in the mode of goodness worship the demigods, right? People in the mode of passion worship demons. And people in the mode of ignorance are worshiping ghosts and spirits. Those are the next few verses of the Bhagavad Gita. And in the previous chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna went into some depth as to what is a demon and what is a demigod. And it's not only like mythic beings, right? He describes people who are prominent in our, you know, public sphere, right in front of our faces, both the divine and the demoniac. And so if we put our faith in a path of progressive goodness, we may worship people with divine qualities. But what is the intent behind worshiping these people? If we endeavor to enjoy and exploit material energy for our own personal sense gratification, we will worship people who have become expert in doing these things. Who is expert in controlling material nature? And this starts on a seemingly subtle and benign level. We might see some great feats of athleticism and think, oh, this guy's my sports hero, sports ball, yay. We just wrapped up the Winter Olympics, so this was prevalent in people's minds. The U.S. versus Canada hockey teams and the heroes of these games. But what is really the purpose of this, right? And so this starts with, we worship these athletes because they've been able to exploit material energy for everybody's entertainment, right? And so that's an example of hero worship. But the Bhagavad Gita actually describes this impulse to want to exploit material energy for our own enjoyment as among the demonic qualities. And then this can turn into, you know, the worship of much larger demons, right? I'm trying to think of an example that won't trigger anybody, but I guess that's impossible. we see this a lot in the material world today through our overall culture of worship of technology, right? There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita in the 7th chapter where it says that in the spiritual world, there's no electricity, right? And so Prabhupada counts electricity, the energy of fire that is coming out of all of our wall sockets here, as an agent of Maya. Right? What is the purpose of all of this electricity, right? The purpose of this electricity, supposedly, is to make our lives easier, right? People used to wash their clothes by rubbing them up and down on a washboard, and that's like a half day's work to do the laundry. So we went and invented the washing machine. So we just plug it into the wall, fire it up, and here we go, you got your laundry. Now we still waste a half a day just watching it sit in a pile on the floor before we put it away. So it's not exactly as though we've saved any time with the washing machine. We've just created the illusion of making our lives easier. And we see that this is basically the nature of technology in general. In dealing with youth, I'm often meditating on this Vedic principle of being Shrutidhar, right? Shrutidhar was the quality of the brahmachari of the bygone age, which means that they could hear once from the spiritual master and remember everything the spiritual master said. Shrutidhar means to hold by hearing, right? The Sanskrit verb dhar, like govar, Shrutidhar means to hold. So to hold by hearing. And that ability in humans was lost. We've experienced a degeneration of our mental faculty, so we took to the technology of writing everything down, right? But nowadays, we don't even write anything down, right? We've switched from writing it down, which is a complicated neurological activity, especially if you're writing a complicated script like Devanagari, or even American or Roman cursive, right? This is a fine neurological connection that's forming subtle tissue between the brain and the very tips of the fingers that is also associated with meaning and symbolism. And so even the act of writing things down, although a step below the ideal of being Shrutidhar, is still pretty advanced technology. But we don't do this anymore. We just type on keyboards. If you're old, right? Like if you're an old person, you might type on a keyboard. If you're under the age of 25, you're not even really doing that anymore. You're speaking to the device. And so even this neurological connection is getting lost. I'm on a huge tangent here, but that's all right. I've avoided talking about politics, which was my main goal. But this propensity to do this, now the kids are all fidgeting. They're all tapping away like this anyway, even when there's no language associated with it. And so this is a degradation of the quality of humanity, because we've invested our energy in technology. And this is actually an example of the demonic influence in human society. And therefore, Prabhupada also preached an agrarian lifestyle, simple living and high thinking. And in addition to wanting to put this philosophy of Bhagavad Dharma out into the world, he also very strongly advocated for developing robust rural self-sustaining communities, to not just preach this principle of simple living and high thinking, or to get back to the basics of what is really required for life, but to also put it into practice. And this, of course, involves us also giving up some of our desires to enjoy a leisurely existence in the material world, right? Working the land is hard work, especially in Florida. The heat comes, the cows get angry, the bugs come out, and so on and so forth. So people worship these things. I wanted to comment again on worshiping in the mode of goodness. Mode of goodness, it's described as worshiping the demigods. And so this doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to worship this demigod or that demigod to get some particular outcome. I'm going to offer prayers to this one god so I can get this one kind of result back. This is actually faith in the mode of passion, because it is again oriented towards what I want out of the equation. Worship of the demigods means to understand that all of our environmental systems here on this earth that provide for our resources are regulated by demigods, and we should act in harmony with them. And when we act in harmony with them, the earth becomes rich and abundant. This is also described in the Bhagavad Gita that in the beginning, oh my God, that was the mode of passion. In the beginning of creation, the Supreme Lord sent forth generation of men and demigods along with the process of sacrifice, saying, be thou happy with this sacrifice, because through its practice you will achieve everything pleasing in this world and the next. And so this sacrifice, the act of being pious, and Krishna will go on in this chapter to explain what it means to engage in sacrifice in the mode of goodness. Through engaging in sacrifice in the mode of goodness, the world becomes abundant. Everything is in harmony. And so this is what it means to really worship the demigods. It means to understand that in the water we drink, there is a spirit, there is a personality who is embodied in this water. The air that we breathe is regulated by a personality. The way these things interact with each other, this is regulated by a personality, Indra, in this particular regard. When we go swim in the ocean, this is the body of a great being, Varuna, right? The Lord of the waters. And so to worship the demigods means to understand who is behind, who is the actor behind material energy. And when that really comes into clear focus, we see that all of these demigods are agents of the Supreme Lord, Krishna. And that's when you can begin to, or when we, I should say, can begin to act in the mode of pure goodness, when we can see who's operating behind all of it, and that is Krishna. So that was a little bit of a tangent into technology, but the point of the first paragraph of what Prabhupada's saying here is that we have become entangled in this world, and as sort of a reflex action, as to try to find a way out of it, we identify with different modes of material nature. We put our faith in these modes of nature. Some people have faith that through intoxication or other kinds of sinful activities, gambling, so on and so forth, I will at least find some temporary cessation of the miseries I'm experiencing in this world. Other people think that if I just go out and make a lot of money, if I just go take this next vacation, right? If I just, get that next promotion, if I can just own that new car, I'll satisfy this itch, this underlying nagging frustration that I have with my material life. And then in other situations, people think, well, if I just live a pious life, if I act according to the laws of nature, if I engage in karma yoga, I will ease the suffering not only of myself, but of my extended community, right? If one person is not free, then nobody is free, kind of thing. And so these are the different divisions of faith. But what Krishna is really advocating here is to come to the mode of pure faith or pure goodness. And this is very difficult in the material world. Everything in the material world is mixed. I'm going to take a sip of water. Excuse me. So this universe is described as an egg, and surrounding the egg, there are different layers. Immediately surrounding the Brahmanda, the egg that we're sitting in, there is a layer of pure earth. And then surrounding that layer of pure earth, there's a layer of pure water, and so on and so forth. And then it becomes progressively more and more subtle until it devolves into the pradana, which is unmanifested material energy. But can you conceive of, in this world, actually pure earth? What does that look like? If you get a handful of soil, even in the hot Florida sun, this is mixed with water. There's some moisture in there. There's plenty of air in the soil. I yelled at some kids the other day because they were stepping on the soil where we're planting the sunflowers. And they're like, why can't I step on the soil? I said, because you're squeezing all the air out of it. I'm like, well, why does the soil need air? It's because the seeds need oxygen to sprout, right? And so even the soil is mixed. So you can dig deeper, right? And you can dig down to the hard Florida bedrock. And you'll find the hard Florida bedrock, thank God, I have to say, is filled with water, right? You hit the bedrock, water comes gushing to the surface. So there's no pure earth. If you go even deeper, below the carbonate reservoir or aquifer here, there's like real ancient hard rock. But if you look at that, there are air pockets in there too. There are fluids trapped in there. And so there's no such thing really as pure earth in this world. Same thing if you look at water. If you go to any surface water around here with a little dropper and put it on a microscope slide and you'll look at it, there's all kinds of stuff in that water. There's air in the water. There's all kinds of living creatures in the water. There's, solid material in the water, dirt and whatnot. So everything is mixed. Everything is mixed in the material world. Even in the air, we look up in the sky, it's filled with clouds. This is water, right? Sometimes those clouds freeze and start falling back down to the earth. And now, luckily, this doesn't happen in Florida too often. Or maybe I should say, unfortunately, it doesn't happen in Florida too often. But when the snow starts falling from the sky, now there's solid stuff mixed with the air. So that everything in the material world is mixed, and it's impossible to escape this on our own. So even though Krishna is talking about the divisions of faith and how to engage in austerities in the mode of goodness, what austerities in the mode of passion look like, Krishna mentions three different divisions here. He mentions austerities, sacrifices, and penances, and food. So food was one of the essential ones that he put in there too. And with austerities, he mentions austerities of the mind, austerities of the body, and austerities of speech. And he breaks down each one of these categories into what this looks like in the mode of goodness, what this looks like in the mode of passion, and what this looks like in the mode of ignorance. But here in the purport, we hear Prabhupada advocating that we put our faith in the mode of pure goodness. So how does that work? I just went into some detail about how everything in the material world is mixed. So how do we come to the platform of faith in pure goodness? What does that look like? And I will just make a couple comments on this to see if anybody has any comments of their own. Well, it says in the Srimad, to answer my own question here, I will say that it says in the Srimad Bhagavatam that in the age of Kali, intelligent persons perform congregational chanting to worship the incarnation of Godhead, who constantly sings the names of Krishna. Although his complexion is not blackish, he is Krishna himself. He is accompanied by his associates, servants, weapons, and confidential companions. So the Bhagavatam here gives the key to how to develop faith in pure goodness, and that is quite specifically to develop faith in the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare. Because Krishna is the source of all consciousness. Our consciousness is limited by association with the modes of material nature, but Krishna never comes under the sway of his material energy. He's always transcendental to it. And I mentioned in the beginning of the class that spiritual life begins with the understanding that we are not these material bodies. But spiritual life comes to its ripened fruit when we understand what the relationship is between our consciousness and the source of our consciousness. That's the relationship between the energy and the energetic source. That relationship is manifested in the mood of bhakti, in the mood of loving devotion. And Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 6, verse 47, in the purport, in explaining the yoga process, that from the beginning of karma yoga, when we begin to understand that the purpose of my life is to disentangle myself from these modes of material nature, from the beginning of karma yoga to the end of bhakti is a long way to self-realization. That's a long way to go. And due to the association of the modes along that road, it's very easy to get lost. It's very easy to get lost, especially with our degraded intelligence of the modern era. Therefore, Krishna also appears in this day and age in the form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he has inaugurated this Sankirtan Yagya. This is the sacrifice of chanting the holy names of God. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also taught us that nam nam akari bahuda nijasarva shaktis tatrapita niyamita smarine nakalaha etadrishi tava kripa bhagavan mamapi durdaivam idrisham ihajani nanuraga. That there are so many names of Krishna. We're chanting Hare Krishna, right? But Prabhupada never cast aspersions on people chanting other names of God. Prabhupada said, Hindu God, Christian God, if you understand what is God, same thing. And if you cannot understand that this is the same thing, then you've not really understood what is God. That's my paraphrasing. Prabhupada didn't say the second part. I also paraphrased the first part. So this is the sacrifice for our day and age, when we can no longer sit at the feet of the spiritual master and hear uninterrupted for days, perfectly remembering not only what was said, but the specific meter and pronunciation in which it was said. We can no longer go to the forest and sit on a deerskin rug and stare at the tip of our nose, breathing only once every 6 months, awaiting for Lord Vishnu to appear and make us the Lord of a star, right, in this universe, or the whole universe, in fact. We lack these abilities. And we see as Kali Yuga progresses, subsequent generations further and further begin to become actually less and less skilled. The powers of the mind, the powers of concentration, the faculties of speech, of critical thinking, these are becoming degraded across the world. And humanity is just becoming really automatons for corporate wage labor, right? Who is really going out there and changing the world in this day and age? It's a very difficult proposition. Very difficult proposition. But if we take this mantra with us wherever we go and incorporate and put our faith in the power of this mantra to purify our consciousness and the power of the vibration of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, not only to spread in this room with its nice reverberating marble floors, and not only, you know, throughout Alachua County, where we represent a significant minority of the population, at least in the town of Alachua, but if we allow the vibration of this mantra to spread out throughout the world and purify everybody, then we can be said to be putting our faith in the mode of pure goodness. So, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Set a precedent for not droning on and on. Any comments, questions, complaints, criticisms, donations? We got some people up here in the front. It looks like we got some people in the back. Oh, go ahead, Maharaj, please.
Just a little detail of the spinning off what you just said. That on the one hand, we hear the Hare Krishna, etc., the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is the panacea, is the real remedy for all the difficulties of this age and life in the material world in general. But then on the other hand, I don't know, is Prabhupada, is it sort of just to get us into the game that he also encourages that any name of God, if you're Christian, you like the name of Mother Mary or Jesus, or that will be, apparently just as good. So is the Hare Krishna mantra unique, or is it just one of any large number of names of God which are all holy and all purifying and all efficacious?
I can speak from my own experience that the Sanskrit language is powerful, right? And so, and especially when it's chanted with attention and proper intent, there's a power behind the Sanskrit language that may not exist in English, and right? And so, and then there also becomes questions of like, Prabhupada mentions in this purport, people concoct their own faith, right? So people invent names of God. And so what is really bona fide, what is not? We can say Allah, and this is referring to the greatest, and this is meditating on this power of God to be the greatest thing. And that's, so we've zoomed the lens in on one aspect of God, and we're associating with that aspect of God. But when we say Krishna, and this is written by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and was sort of summarized by Srila Prabhupada in their introduction to the Brahma Samhita, that Krishna is really the best nomenclature for the transcendental person because it encompasses anything that you might want. If I'm acknowledging that God, Krishna, is the all-attractive person, then any other quality that I might be interested or after is embedded in that. So I think there is an aspect of that, and I've noticed that also chanting Sanskrit properly. I was mentioning with writing Devanagari and how this is developing subtle neurological tissues between the connection of the brain and the connections of the fingers, which is a long way to go in the body. By chanting Sanskrit properly, meaning by knowing where you're supposed to put your tongue in your mouth, knowing what the actions of the lips are supposed to be, knowing what the teeth are supposed to do, and so on and so forth, with every single syllable, is also developing those subtle neurological connections between the brain and the tongue and the comprehension of what that all means. So this is an advanced science. This is an advanced science, actually, chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, that has been lost to modern scientists because modern scientists have no way of understanding what consciousness is. They call this the hard problem. They can't study consciousness with the scientific method because the observer cannot escape from the observation when studying consciousness. So there is an aspect of Krishna that is all-encompassing, but I think it's also important to recognize that everybody is on a gradual path of progression. But even Allen Ginsberg asked Prabhupada, why don't you call it the International Society for God Consciousness? That would be, is that what you wanted to say, Mother Vega? No, okay. So Allen Ginsberg, who was in a position to really help Srila Prabhupada spread his movement deeply into the heart of American culture, so why don't you call it the International Society for God Consciousness? And Prabhupada said, no, it's the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, because Krishna is a person and that's his name. He didn't want to be impersonal about it. So there's a lot of paradoxes in all things in Krishna consciousness, but we all here, I think, have this pratyaksha that there is a power in the Maha Mantra that may not have been existent in the prayers of our fathers or whatever. Yeah, Mother Vega, you're so eager to say something. Go ahead. Yeah. Go for it.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Maharaj.
This is in response to Maharaj's question. That's why I was raising my hand so eagerly. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has an essay called Universal Religion. I'm going to have to paraphrase, but he's basically said, wherever there's a culture of pure love of God, and we're like Ahoitukiya Pratihata, uninterrupted, unmotivated, that level, there talking about Vrindavan, but they may not have the words Gopi, yeah. Gopa, and Govardhan Hill. So that kind of answers to my mind. It's, the culture is pure love of God.
Yeah.
And Krishna can do magic. And then he will put somebody in touch with the Maha Mantra. But we're, yeah.
As he did with all of us.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Marlon Prabhu. Hare Krishna. You're welcome. Here comes the microphone.
So we are part and parcel of Krishna, meaning that we have the same qualities of Krishna, it's just not in the same quantity. By nature, we are marginal energy. Where is that quality in Krishna to be marginal? How come we have that quality but Krishna doesn't?
We are that quality of Krishna. That's us.
But Krishna doesn't have it?
No, we are the Krishna that is the marginal energy. We are that quality of Krishna. So Krishna has to have marginal energy. To your point again, I think with prayer, a lot of it also has to do with intent. And intent is often mixed with understanding and knowledge. As our knowledge increases, our intent can become more pure. And so we hear, for example, I'm going to come back to your point in a moment. We hear in a lot of Pala Shruti, right, in our scriptures, which are enticing the living entity to engage in acts of devotion with the enticement of some kind of reward. And I've often wondered at this because that's actually not pure devotion, you know, may your chanting be blissful or whatever, but actually the purpose of my chanting is not for me to be blissful. The purpose of my chanting is to give pleasure to Krishna, and that is a very different thing. So if somebody is praying to Jesus because, you know, they have some, I'm not picking on Christians here, it's just a common example. If somebody's praying to Jesus because, you know, they want some money, then the power of this, Jesus may fulfill their desires, but that's not the point. And so the chanting of the name of Krishna in order to evoke some sort of boon for myself is not as powerful as the chanting of the name of Krishna for the pleasure of Krishna's. You know, so Krishna can hear beautiful music made by this little tiny living entity, you know, so he can dance in the moonlight or whatever with some nice song. And in the same way, somebody playing for Jesus to be just a pure instrument of God's love in this world, regardless of whatever vocabulary they're looking for, may be, more powerful than somebody who's chanting Hare Krishna externally, but is actually committing sinful activities on the strength of chanting the holy name. Just a quick story before I come back to Marlon's point here. When I was living in a temple in outside of Portland, we had this ranch with this really nice, it was on a Christmas tree farm overlooking Mount Hood. It was a really beautiful property. And this one guy joined the temple and was so eager. He was chanting, he was getting up in the morning, he was a little older than the standard brahmachari. He might have been in his early 30s or something. And he's fired up, right? He's cooking, he's cleaning, he's got a dhoti on, he's chanting in the morning. And one day we get a call from the FBI, and the FBI is like, is there this guy? You know, he gave us this name, and it wasn't the guy's name, but it fit his description. And we were like, oh yeah, that guy's here. And he said we had a tip that this guy might be hanging out in the Hare Krishna temple. He's wanted for murder. And we're like, well, he's here. And he's like, the guy on the FBI was like, don't do anything. Don't let him leave. We'll be right there. And like 3 hours later, they flew into Portland. They had to drive 45 minutes from the Portland airport. So this guy was chanting Hare Krishna, like making a big show of being a bhakta. But in reality, he was trying to hide up some very sinful activities. And so that's obviously, even though he's chanting Hare Krishna, the quality and the intent of that prayer is not the same as someone who might be praying to Jesus, although certainly Jesus was not that personality's name, right? That's a, I mean something, yeah, some transliteration. I'm gonna answer his question. Yeah, I'm gonna answer his question. Thanks, I got you. I got it, thanks. All right, well, you can answer his question. So, to answer your question, so knowledge informs our intent. And having a proper knowledge of God can inform how we're praying to him. So one of the features of God, thank you, is that God is unlimited, which means we can't say that God is purely transcendental, and we can't say that God is ever not contaminated by material energy. And we can't say that God can't go back between these two things, because then we are putting a limit on God. And so we are the living entity. The jiva is the part of Krishna that is marginal. We are also Krishna. We are the part of Krishna that is marginalized. So we talk about achintya, beta, abeda, tattva, and because we are, you know, on a crusade against the Mayavadis, we place a lot of emphasis on how we are different from Krishna. We place a lot of emphasis on the relationship of the servant to the receiver of service. But we are also Krishna. We are also the same as Krishna. We are the part of Krishna that is marginal. So we are the manifestation of Krishna's marginal energy.
Just a really quick follow-up. How milk can turn to yogurt.
Yeah.
Yogurt cannot turn back to milk.
Right.
We say kind of that's what Shiva is, and Krishna is milk and Shiva is the yogurt. Could not Shiva be the part of Krishna that's mixed and that's marginal?
Shiva, I don't want to go into too much detail about this because I'm going to say something that's wrong, but Shiva is his own thing. Shiva is his own tattva, which is another example of Krishna's unlimited energies. And even in the Bhagavatam, Shiva is referred to as the Supreme Lord in certain situations.
Thank you.
Yeah. We got a couple more. All right. Up here in the front. Yes, sir.
Thank you for class.
Yeah.
I was reading Jiva Dharma earlier today, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur were summarizing different adhikars.
Yeah.
Dharma adhikar, Gyan adhikar, and Bhakti adhikar. And I thought it was interesting because he mentioned that those that do not have any adhikar are considered mlechas. So I was thinking, the only thing that Prabhupada came to give us is bhakti adhikar, so how is it that we get stuck in these lower adhikars that we didn't really have qualification for in the first place?
Well, that is the mercy of the spiritual master, that although we are wholly unqualified to enter into the realms of bhakti, the spiritual master comes and opens the door for us anyway, and stands at the doorway and just like constantly like cajoles us, get in here. But we don't go in all the time, or we go in and we walk back out, right? And so we are very much attached to material energy, and that is our lack of adhikar. And you know, we don't really have much adhikar to begin with. And this is also the potency of the spiritual master, is that he's able to take people with no adhikar and lift them up to a platform of at least advancing adhikar, you know, at least. Yes. Yeah, thank you. Adhikar means qualification in this regard. So this is the causeless mercy of the Lord and the pure devotee. And we should never really consider ourselves qualified to receive this. We should always chant Hare Krishna in a humble state of mind. You know, as soon as we start chanting Hare Krishna thinking that I've now made some advancement in my adhikar, now I've been chanting Hare Krishna so long, you know, I followed Ekadashi so perfectly yesterday, or whatever. As soon as we start thinking like this, then we've walked back out the door that the spiritual master is open for us. And so this is why, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said, in the morning we should beat our minds with a stick, and in the evenings we should beat our minds with a shoe, or maybe it was vice versa. But, you know, we are, our qualification is very low, and we begin to become qualified when we remember that. Hare Krishna. I think we had time for one more back here. Yeah, thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Sir, which statement is more true? We chant Hare Krishna to achieve moksha and union with Krishna, or we chant Hare Krishna to increase faith in the mode of goodness in the world?
The Bhagavatam says that whether you're full of desires, you have no desires, or you're desiring liberation, you should just worship Krishna. You should just chant Hare Krishna. The best is to chant Hare Krishna in a mood of total surrender, that I'm just, I'm just going, whatever happens, I'm just going to give my life to you, and here we go. Now it's Hare Krishna all the way. I heard a story of a man who is dying in a hospital in, I think in Kenya, in Mombasa, and he was in a coma for a long time, days before he died. He was just in a coma, and the devotees were gathered around him, chanting, you know, doing all the things devotees do when someone's leaving their body. And at one point, he just sprang up in his bed, and he pointed up at the ceiling, and he said, "Now it's Hare Krishna all the way." And then he leaned back and died. And so, it's just Hare Krishna all the way. So we should chant Hare Krishna in that mood. We should understand what is the point. The point is that I am not the enjoyer. I'm not the controller. The purpose of my consciousness is to give pleasure to the Supreme Consciousness. And in this day and age, we're chanting Hare Krishna for his pleasure. And in that mood, I'm going to hear every syllable. I'm going to pronounce every word right. I'm not going to scroll on my phone while I'm chanting. I'm not going to, you know, think about what I'm eating for lunch, or, you know, all the things that we think about when I'm chanting. And then, you know, the things that we think about when I'm chanting pop back up in our head, and we do our best to struggle with it in whatever we can. Understanding that if I live my life in the mode of goodness, if I refrain from things that are harmful to my Krishna consciousness, and if I make an endeavor to engage in things that are helpful for my Krishna consciousness, it'll be easier to concentrate. But the goal is to chant Hare Krishna all the time. Right, that's the part of the Shishashtakam that I quoted. The last verse is that I'm so unfortunate. The last stanza or last line is that I'm so unfortunate I have no taste for it, which is basically true. I mean, we have a taste for chanting a round or two, and then it starts to get hard, you know, or you know, I like this kirtanya, I don't like that kirtanya, or you know, we have so many conditions we set on whether or not I'm going to enjoy the chanting. But we don't need any of that. These are all just material conditions. And so it takes you, the Christians say, keep your eyes on the prize, right? So no matter what we're going through in our lives, and we all go through so much hardship, there's so many obstacles, there's so many opportunities to go astray, but if we just remember what the goal is, then Krishna will help us along the way, for sure.
Thank you so much.
Hare Krishna. I think one more, I guess. Some people go on for hours. I just go on for 1 hour. Hare Krishna. Here comes the mic.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
The faith, you talked about the faith, specifically it will develop Bhagavatam reading and chanting, and what are the other suggestions we can give?
For what?
The faith, for the complete faith.
I would just say read the Bhagavatam. Yeah. That's the only citation you need. The whole Bhagavatam is a recitation of faith. In fact, the Bhagavatam is filled with prayers. You can open up any section. The prayers of the personified Vedas, for example, in the tenth canto of the Bhagavatam, chapter 88. The prayers of Queen Kunti. Is that what you were going to say? No. There's so many. I mean, our Bhagavatam is just filled with statements of faith. You open up to any page and just read it, and your faith will increase. I guarantee it. Read it out loud, right? Don't read it in your mind. Pronounce the Sanskrit, pronounce the English, read the words of the Acharya, and your faith will increase without end.
So reading the story?
Yes. Hearing from the Acharya, yes. Hearing the stories of the great devotees of the Lord. This will increase your faith. I mean, we think we have difficulties in our lives, right? But look at what Prahlad Maharaj went through. You know, his father had him thrown off a cliff. Jeepers. All right. Ruchira, last word here. So, here comes the mic. Let's get you. I didn't get the last part.
I was going to say, besides worshiping the Srimad Bhagavatam by hearing, association with devotees is also a very important part.
Yes, thank you. Yes, actually, association with devotees comes right after Shraddha on the path. There's Shraddha and then there's Sadhu Sangha. So the keeping the association with devotees is an example of our faith. And Prabhupada wrote in this purport that I read about our faith should be productive of positive works. So yes, we put our faith in the association of devotees. I think here it's a little bit easy to take it, the association of devotees for granted because they're everywhere. So if you really want to increase your faith, go associate with some non-devotees for a little while. Like, whoa, I'm going back to those people. All right. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Let us feast. Hare Krishna.